Hey, welcome to a new episode of Skin in the Game. This is your host, John Simperman, with my co-host,
Tim O'Shai. John, you sound really good through that screen that I'm looking at right now.
Well, we had to do, everybody's been on the road, but we were fortunate a few weeks back to bring in Sabres, Detroit Red Wings alumni, Danny Gehr, actually in studio, and can't wait to get to our conversation with Danny.
You know, along with being a hockey legend in those two cities, Danny's a great businessman. We're gonna dig deep into that and the project, a company he has going right now that is making the sport of hockey available to people who, you know, may not be able to access the ice time otherwise.
Right. You know, and we talk a lot on Skin in the Game, you know, about the business of sports. And we've even, Tim, you know, in past episodes talked about how the athlete evolves post-career, where do they go post-career? And I think that the conversation with Danny is going to be enlightening because, you know, they would know Danny from his, 354 goals on the ice. They would know Danny from the number 18 in the rafters at the arena in Buffalo. Maybe even know him from his broadcasting days, both down in Florida as well in Western New York. What they might not know is, what he is doing as a business person now. So, can't wait to unravel that.
Yeah, and we'll get into this, but it's really instructive, too, for what athletes can do and frankly need to do during their career and shortly after their playing career ends to set up the rest of their life, right? So we're going to dig into that. And, you know, Danny, it should be said, John, Danny did these things. He set up that post-hockey career at a time when there wasn't such an emphasis on it for guys in his position. Nowadays, at minimum, athletes hear from their players association, from their league, from their teams, like, hey, this is not going to last forever, and we're going to give you resources to set yourself up post-sports, post-playing. That was not happening, you know, at least not in any broad level back when Danny was playing. So he was ahead of the game on that, and I know people are going to love this conversation. Before we get to that, though, John, you are a guy who's got perspective on, I'm going to put this like very plainly, where sports arenas and stadiums should be located. And one of my favorite things to do is ask you, hey, John, what would you do with an arena, in Buffalo, or where would you put a Buffalo Bills stadium, or Cleveland, your hometown, is going to build a new football stadium? Where should it go? So I'm going to pass it over to you to fill everyone in on some of the news that we've been talking about, but I'm eager for your take.
You're kind of putting me in a box here because, as you know, I'm always a big fan of building the sports complexes in the heart of the city. Accessible.
Which you did. And I want people to know you did that in Los Angeles.
But I got to tell you, Cleveland, finally, the city of Cleveland and the Haslams, the owners of the Cleveland, looks like they buried the hatchet because it's been a rough 6 months. And they've agreed to allow the Cleveland Browns to build a stadium in Brook Park, which is about 12 miles outside of the city. And I know, Tim, you're going to say to me, oh, John, you must hate that. Well, actually, in this case, I do think it's a good idea. And let me tell you why. Number one is they're opening up the lakefront in downtown Cleveland for 365 days of activation versus 8 days, right? That's prime real estate. Open up that real estate, condos, development, let people enjoy the Great Lake. Number two, I mentioned Brook Park. That's actually the home of, you know, the Cleveland Airport. And it's also, get this, on the rail line. So you have accessibility directly out to the stadium in the suburbs. And then if you've seen these very aggressive plans in Cleveland, I mean, you're talking about, they're going to be building a title town development around it. So it checks a lot of the boxes. But for me, it opens up the waterfront for Clevelanders and it really has super accessibility for public transportation, air transportation, you know, however you need to get there.
Here's the box I would put you in, John, and tell me if I've got this right. Number one, the stadium needs to go in a place where people can get to it. As obvious as that sounds, it's not always the case, right? People, and when I say people can get to it, it means they can do more than drive. They can take buses, they can take a railway, they can take public transportation, maybe even they can walk, right? Number two, the development that's going to go around that stadium needs to be needed in that city And there needs to be the infrastructure to support it and the population to support it. In other words, if you're going to build a title town, and that's a Green Bay reference, of course, but if you're going to build a title town around a stadium in Cleveland, make sure there's enough Clevelanders who are going to want to go to that and keep that place busy without drawing too much away from other entertainment hubs in Cleveland. Do I have that right?
You do, and enough activity around it so you could support 300 nights of entertainment versus just 8 or 10. But here's the other thing that is really interesting. As part of this development, you know, the city of Cleveland, the county, Cuyahoga County, as well as the Browns, they're working with the Regional Transit Authority to invest about $40 million into a rail line. You know, I think, that, again, that's super valuable. If you've ever been to a game, and a Yankees game at the Bronx, or headed out to Wrigley Field in Chicago, you know, I know people love tailgating, but guess what? Those train rides into Wrigley can be an awful lot of fun too. So they're building the infrastructure around the stadium. It looks like it's all moving forward for the Cleveland Browns to play football in Brook Park, Ohio.
Just as a side note, we've talked so much on this program, John, about, you know, the public giving money to you know, what would otherwise be a private project that, you know, could or should be funded by billionaires, right? So New York State, Erie County giving $850 million toward a Buffalo Bills stadium project is an example we've talked about a lot. You know, in Cleveland, and this is a comparatively smaller example of money going the other way, but the Haslams are giving money to the public to help develop that waterfront that's going to be open once their current stadium gets torn down. I think it's $100 million.
Yeah, no. I'm glad you brought that up. It's almost like it's a kind of the exit clause, right? You know, we're going to let you go to the suburbs, but you need to write us $100 million check, which is, first of all, going to help pay for the demolition of the current stadium, but also it is going to help then build the development. So the city of Cleveland, I guess good for them, you know, negotiated a pretty good deal. If the Browns were going to move 12 miles, you know, at least they got something to show for it. And that they really have some seed funds to use that, you know, and develop that lakefront. So, you know, there's a lot of, you know, sports stories of fighting and threatening to move and this, that, and the other thing. You know, in this case, I think cooler heads prevailed.
Yeah, it worked out. How incredible for the lakefront area in Cleveland.
And I think there's something to be learned for all of the markets, you know, whether our listeners are in Hamilton, whether our listeners are in Buffalo, Rochester, and beyond. I just think, you know, see what's happening in these other markets, then we can kind of learn from them. And we don't have time because we do need to get into our conversation with Danny Gear. But I think coming up in the next few weeks, Tim, we do need to talk about arena development, renovations. There's a great building being kind of rebuilt up in Hamilton, and we need to talk about that.
We can plan to talk about, you know, some of the good work that's been done too. I think of TD Garden in Boston, right? That's one that, you know, I've spent and you've spent a lot of time at, and we've talked about on Skin in the Game previously too, right? So that'll be a good discussion for you and I and for the guests that we'll be bringing in, and looking forward to that. But in the meantime, time to talk hockey, career transitions, and synthetic ice with Danny Gare.
Yeah, number 18 is going to be in studio here, so stay tuned on Skin in the Game.
Hey, football fans, check out the USA Wheelchair Football League Tournament, presented by Buffalo Toronto Public Media. Cheer on our very own Buffalo Bills as they face off with the Patriots, the Cowboys, the Raiders, and the Browns.
Something up. It's picked off.
Head to the Buffalo Toronto Public Media YouTube channel to stream it now.
Hey, welcome back to Skin in the Game. I would like to welcome in studio number 18 from your Buffalo Sabres, the one, the only, Danny Gear.
Good to see you guys.
How are you, Danny?
I'm good.
Danny and I go back quite a few years. Actually, we were reminiscing. I think we first met back in 99 when I was running the marketing for the Sabres. And Danny was in the booth, around the booth, on the rink. So
anybody, Danny, who can bring the dirt on John. Well, is an especially welcome the dirt. Guest here.
That's going to be a different episode. That's going to be a different episode.
Yeah, that comes after we turn the
yeah, that's after a few beers, maybe. Yeah. No, it's great to be here. Thank you for inviting me. I'm looking forward to it. And like I said, John and I go back a long ways. He's been a good friend for many years, and we get to play some golf and hang out. And
talk some hockey.
Talk some hockey. Yeah. And
well, what we want to do here, we do want to talk a little hockey. We want to a lot talk about the business side of it and what you're now doing at business side. Mm-hmm. But first, I did have a hockey related question. I'm just not sure this ratio is correct, but let me think. Career goals, 354 around there.
Something like that. Yeah.
Penalty minutes, well over 1,200.
Yeah, you know, I probably could have hit the 400 goal easily if I wouldn't have stayed out of this, if I would have stayed out of the penalty box. But back then, it was a tough man's game, and they all wanted to go after me, so I just had to stand up for myself.
Yeah, you know, I got when I moved to Buffalo, New York. I think you and I had a chance to meet at a few Sabres alumni golf tournaments, and I had friends of mine that wanted to join our foursome, but they couldn't because they were still intimidated by you.
Well, after my career got over, I was happy not to be able to go after guys like Schultz and Selesky and Gillies and so forth. So it was kind of a nice thing.
Yeah, you got to keep the broadcast face.
Yeah,
going,
you
got to
keep the face alive and teeth cleaned. And that's right.
For our listeners in Southern Ontario, our listeners in Western New York, you decided actually to stay in Western New York and actually raise a family here in Buffalo.
Yeah, I did. I was traded to Detroit. And I played there for five years. And it was a difficult time for me. And my wife at the time was pregnant. And I remember going there and they weren't a good team. And it was a shock to be traded, to be one, you know, with Schoenfeld. It was my dad was dying of ALS at the time, too. So it was a tough year, very difficult year. But then when my daughter Danielle was born the following May, it was who cared, you know, and then Mike Ilitch bought the team and he made me the captain. And we went on to, you know, to make the playoffs back to back. Two times when Yzerman came, Stevie sat next to me. I was 18, he was 19. So I ended up, you know, coming back to Buffalo. We still had a place here. Ended up building a home in Lotus Bay. And we lived on the lake and enjoyed it here and became, you know, working with Channel 49 a little bit back in those days and worked with Empire Sports Network and had a restaurant out there. So it kept me busy and the kids were growing and it was a good transition. But, you know, I always wanted to stay and be a part of the game as much as I could.
Well, you know, I talked to you. You were born and raised out in
Nelson, British Columbia.
And I think you've said to me that kind of the feel, the vibe of Western New York kind of reminded you a lot of that, of how you were raised.
Very much so. And I think, you know, although much larger, my town was a big town, but, you know, it's always been known Buffalo is a city of good neighbors. And I think that that's just how it all came about. And when I played here, it was like, never missed the playoffs. We sold out every game. You know, we went to the finals my first year against Philadelphia. We won a couple of Wales trophies and championships, which would be now the President's Trophy for most points. And we had great teams and great personality, and the fans just embraced us.
Do you miss it?
The first 5 years are the years that you miss it, you know, because you start playing when you're, 4 or 5 years old, and then you play competitive hockey when you're... I left home at 16 to play junior in Calgary, Alberta. Played there, and then I come into here. Punch drafts me in 74, and come make the team, which was amazing, and then score my first goal in 18 seconds against Bobby Orr and the Boston Bruins. It was like, maybe I belong. We had an outstanding year that year. I scored 30 goals, was runner-up for Rookie of the Year, and we go to the finals and unfortunately lose to Bernie Parent and the Philadelphia Flyers, which I'll never forget, but I thought it was going to happen every year. I did. Yeah.
It seems like you've been able to build a really exciting, fulfilling life post-hockey, which is certainly not a guarantee for guys
there was no education for us after hockey. I'll give the NHL Alumni Association now a lot of credit because there's after programs after guys get out, whether it's I did do some of those when they started, like broadcasting, public speaking. Went to drive to Toronto and would take courses, and it was great. It was a great opportunity for me. Got myself, you know, better acclimated in those situations, and had a number of guys that were in the same position as me and got to hang out with them. And I think it helped the transition, and especially in broadcast, it was great because I had no schooling and understanding. I mean, I had guys like Rick Jenneret and Ted Darling that helped a little bit when they, I mean, they helped, you know, but they were busy doing what they had to do. And then I had guys, producers like Joe Pinter and other people in the organization that helped me along the way too. So it was, it was a learning experience. Anytime something's learning and you're live, like you were on ice, you know, it's fun. And it gets you going. It gets you, you know, it gets the heart pumping and showtime, baby. Let's go.
You got the butterflies.
It's showtime. Like
right.
And I remember the first time I'm talking and I hear in my IFB, the producer talking, and I'm going, what the hell is that? You know, like I'm going, I'm talking, now you're disrupting my train of thought. You know, don't talk to me when I'm talking, you know, wait till I'm done. So there was always that in and out. But no, I enjoyed it very much. And I got to work with some of the best, you know, I mean, John Kelly, who was we were the first broadcasters for the Lightning. I went to Columbus and worked with Jeff Rimmer, who was a career broadcaster for the Capitals in Florida, and then with the Blue Jackets. And then there was, you know, guys like Brian Duff and, you know, people of that sort, and Howard Simon, you know, back in the day.
Right. Well, Danny, before we get into too much of the future, there's a story you told me when you were drafted. And we talk about today's NHL, Tim, right? It's lights, it's camera, it's action, it's a show, right? Well, back in the day, how did you find out you were drafted as an NHL player?
Well, that year was the first year the WHA came in. And the WHA drafted players 2 weeks before the NHL draft. My best friend and one of my kid I grew up with and was number one by the WHA, Pat Price. He was from my hometown. So I was drafted in the second round by Winnipeg Jets, and John Ferguson was the general manager, the old Montreal Canadian, good guy. So I didn't think much about it. I was always waiting because the NHL was what I always wanted to, you know, and this was new, you know, the WHA. I did get a call from John Ferguson and said, you know, we're drafted. And I said, well, John, appreciate it, but I'm leaning towards what the NHL draft is. 2 weeks later, the NHL goes underage to match what the WHA. They had to, or else they would have lost a lot of great prospects. That year, I was a 29th pick overall. And by the way, ESPN, someone just texted me, I was the best 29th pick ever.
Nice.
Saw it about a week ago. Yeah. So anyways, but a little plug. But prior to the draft, my good friend and my teammate Grant Mulvey, who played with Chicago, my roommate in Calgary, calls me up and wishes me good luck. Well, he went number 6 to Chicago. I went 29. There were 13 underage picks in the first round. This was prior to me finding out I get drafted. This was after, I should say. And I mowing the lawn on a Saturday morning in Nelson. And I was one of my jobs. Dad was big in making sure the lawn and the yard looked good. And we didn't have like flat lawns because we lived on hills because a lot of mountains. And so I'm pushing the mower up and it's rawr, rawr, rawr. And my mom, and I'm about, you know, I don't know, 50 yards or 50 feet from where my mom was on the deck. I can't, on the porch. She yells out, Danny, Danny, Danny. And I can barely hear her because of the mower. And I look back and see her, and she's waving her hands and screaming, Danny. I said, what? I turned the mower off. Punch Imlach's on the phone. I said, oh, okay. You know, because it's a 3-hour time change, right? This was about 11 in the morning, and I'm sweating. It's hot. And I go running in, my shirt's off, and get on the phone. And he goes, Danny, Punch Imlach here. Wanted to let you know the Sabres, we just drafted you in the second round, number 29. And I go, oh, that's great, Punch. I'm so excited to hear that. Thank you so much. You'll be hearing from John Anderson, he said, in the next hour or two to let you know what, you know, the situation and what, blah, blah, blah. So, yeah, I was mowing the lawn when I got drafted. And I remember Marty Biron telling me, he says, you were mowing the lawn? I said, yeah. He says, most guys are decked out in $1,000 suits, you know, at the arena where they're getting drafted with all their fam. But anyways, it just tells you how the climate has changed. So long story short, I'll tell you a quick story, John. From that, you know, there was a lot of, we had agents that came across Canada and were really, you know, promoting, obviously, their talents. And they went to our owner of the Calgary Centennials, who was Scotty Monroe at the time, and said, you know, we'd like to have some of your players. And he got a piece back, I think, from it, you know, which is normal. But I remember... John Ferguson saying, you know, Punch had offered me a real good contract, 5 years. I think it was $600,000 for 5 years. This was 50 years ago.
That's a big, yeah.
It was good money. I mean, $150,000 signing bonus. I mean, it was good money. So John Ferguson called me back after Punch made that and offer, and he says, I'll match it. WHA... They had Bobby Hull then in Winnipeg. They had Ulf Nielsen, Anders Hedberg. They had a good team. And it was Western Canada. And I just wanted to play in the NHL. I mean, I grew up watching Hockey Night in Canada every night, or every Saturday night, Montreal and Toronto. And I'll never forget the year before, my last year junior in Calgary, which I had a great year. I broke the record for goals by a right winger, 68. I broke the record for penalty minutes, 238. I was a first all-star. But I saw the Sabres play the Montreal Canadiens. And it was the thank you Sabres. It was six games they lost. It was the first year they went to the playoffs. And I'm looking at it, I'm hearing Rene Robert's name. I'm hearing Rick Martin's name. I'm hearing Gilbert Perreault. I'm hearing Jim Schoenfeld. I'm hearing, you know, guys that I'd never heard about before. I mean, they were stars, and they were a young team, and they were up and coming. And I'm thinking, you know, when I got drafted, you know, by Punch, I'm thinking about that. And that was the reason why I ended up coming to Buffalo. And Punch was great. He said, Danny, I'm flying out. I think the draft was middle of May, and he came out on Father's Day, June 14th. Signed me, had the contract, flew to Calgary from Toronto. I went in from Nelson to fly into Calgary, signed it. I was with him for about 45 minutes. And then he flew back to Toronto because it was Father's Day, but he came out. So I'm waiting for my flights at 4 o'clock to come back to Nelson. And I can't buy a beer. I'm not old enough. I can't do anything to celebrate this guy. And I remember I calling my mom and dad, and my mom picks up the phone. She goes, Danny, how'd it go? I said, everything went great. You know, I got a check for $150,000 in my pocket. Don't lose that check, she says. So, yeah, it was pretty. And then I come here to Buffalo, and it was just right off the get-go. It went, you know, like you say, my first year. Who would ever think I'd go to the finals and have the year I had with Luce and Ramsey, you know, on a checking line. So
yeah, that's so crazy. So we ready to jump to the, well, I don't know about the future, John, but I'd like to talk about like the future from athletes into
into that
post-hockey career.
Yeah.
So Danny, when you decided or recognized or when you were told, however it all worked out, that the playing career was over, what thought process were you going through to figure out what would be next?
Well, I have to preempt this. That was the word I was looking for earlier. But after I got released by the Red Wings, my contract was up with them. And I still felt that I could give it another year or two. In my mind, I think everybody thinks that. I mean, look at Mr. Rogers from Pittsburgh. You know, right. Everybody thinks that. And, you know, my back wasn't bad. You know, I was working out a lot. And I remember we were building the house on the lake. And my wife, Marianne, at the time said, I want to give it one more shot. I think I can, you know, I'd like to win a cup before I'm done, you know, because I was close. And I thought, well, she says, well, who do you think is going to win the cup? I said, Edmonton. Well, they didn't win it last year. And I knew Wayne Gretzky. I'd played with him. I knew Mike Barnett, his agent. I knew Glenn Sather a bit, you know. And I called up Mike Barnett, who worked with IMG and Wayne and had some guys, and he said, why don't you just give Glenn a call and see what he says, you know? I talked to Glenn. Glenn was great. He says, you know, how's everything going? His family's good, you know, body's pretty good. And I always said that I'd heard rumors that they were trying to get me even when I was in Detroit because they needed a winger at the time. You know, they'd won two cups, and they were young, and they were having fun and enjoying, and I just thought that I could maybe, you know, say to them, guys, we got to tighten this up, and because you're going to win many cups, you know. So anyways, he says, what do you want, a contract or a tryout? I said, I'd love a contract. He goes, I'll get back to you. He goes, okay. So he sends me, calls me and says, I'll give you a tryout. I worked out the hardest I worked out all summer. I was in great shape. I went to Edmonton, was invited, you know, 100 guys. I hadn't done that since rookie season. But he put me in the main dressing room next to Messier. And I had I was the only guy in it for like 10 days. And I ended up making the cut to get to the main camp, and then fortunately made the team. And he said to me, I'll sign you to January 1st. And I said, no, I don't, I'm here. I want to, he says, okay, you know, Dan, I got mad. And I said, look, I made your team. I've been here to help you win a cup. And he says, I'll sign you to March 1st. So March 1st, okay, fine. So we're in first place, March 1st, everything's good. And he brings in Yaroslav Puzar, who was a guy that played in Czechia that won the cup with them 2 years before that. And I didn't play for some games. And I got upset about it, and we met. And he says, Dan, he says, what do you want to do? I said, well, I told you I want to win a cup. I'm here to, you know, I'll go to the minors if I have to. And you had to play one shift to get a ring. Long story short, I retired. I said, I'm done. I poolside from the first place team with Messier and Gretzky with champagne and shrimp cocktails, and that's why I left the game. Mm, yeah. So it was, and the end of that is that we're down in Sarasota at a place on Lido Key, and I get a call from Bill Twilley, the PR director, where the Oilers could have won the cup in Philadelphia in game 6. The guys want me to fly me in, and I flew in. They lost that game. So now we're coming back on the private charter. I said, now what? We're going, we want you to come to Edmonton for game 7. This is 86. And I said, oh, really? Marianne goes, I got no clothes. I got nothing. I said, well, we'll buy some. Don't worry about it. So I go on the plane, and here's Glenn and Ann Sather sitting there. And Glenn Sather goes, Danny. I said, Glenn, how are you? Oh, good to see you. He goes, I said, good to see you too. He says, I told you I'm here to help you win a cup. And they ended up winning game 7. So,
wow.
Yeah. Pretty cool.
Something special packed in that.
Well,
talk
it
there.
Was like, and then they wanted me to stay for the parade. I said, I got to go home to the kids. I said, Mass is telling me, we'll see you down the road. Yeah. No, it was pretty special there. Those, and then when retiring, coming back was, you know, just getting into trying to do stuff. You know, it was like,
so you came back home here to, well, came home, Buffalo. Yeah.
Buffalo, yeah, and I built a house. Marianne's parents had 6 acres in Lotus Bay, and they wanted to sell. And I said, I'll buy, Grandpa, if I buy half of it, build it, I'll pay you for your lot, you know. And so we worked it out, and I worked at Channel 49 with Mr. Mooney, Seymour the Fourth.
Right.
How did you come to opening a restaurant? And I will tell you, I want to tell you, people remember it.
Yeah.
To this day, I told a couple of people, my wife being one of them, like, hey, we're having Danny Guerra on this week. Said, my mom and dad used to go to his restaurant all the time. Yeah. They used to take me.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it was interesting because my neighbor was Richie Alberts, who ran Mickey Rats and Captain Kids. He was my neighbor, and Richie I'd known for years from hanging out in the bars in the city and whatever. And he said, you know, the old Beef and Bottle here is for sale. That's what the name of it was. And I said, really? I said, he says, well, save me from driving all the way in to go for a beer or having dinner somewhere. So we threw some money in. It wasn't crazy, and took it over. I mean, we had people there that would come from all over. And we had, I remember Janice Oaken, the old critic from the Buffalo News, yeah. She gave us 4.5 stars, and she'd always come in or camouflage or something, or you couldn't recognize her. And I said,
was never in the paper.
Right? So anyways, yeah, no, it was fun. It was interesting. You know, the food seemed to be good, and it was only a mile from my house. So we had a lot of fun there.
So I want, because I do want to talk present day, but there's one more thing, Danny. You've been around the game of hockey much longer than Tim and I have at a professional level, and you spent some time in Florida, right?
Yeah.
And when you were with Esposito in
Phil,
Florida, when they launched the Lightning, and there are a lot of naysayers, non-traditional markets.
Right.
How's hockey going to work down there? Well, guess what? It's work down there.
You think?
What's the secret sauce we now have? What, two or three of the last Stanley Cups are in Florida?
Five of the last 6 years.
What's the secret sauce?
Since I went there in 92?
Yeah, I think it was 92.
92 was when the Lightning came aboard. And I remember talking to Phil about an opportunity going down there. You know, I had a place in Florida. I loved the area. My kids came down for a while, and we were brand new, obviously, in an area that was strictly football, baseball. You know, hockey was not, although you had a lot of Northerners, from Toronto and you know, New York, Detroit, whatever, Buffalo. And I remember doing the first open house they had at Expo Hall, you know, where they were playing that little rink there for 10,000 people their first year. So a big part of it, I think, was educating, you know, fans that were down there, people that lived there. But once they saw the game, our very first game we played, we announced. It was a great opening night. Alan Thicke came in. The Esposito brothers, they had pyrotechnics, which you never saw back then, 30 years. It was amazing. There was still fog in the place. But we played the Chicago Blackhawks, who went to the finals and beat them 7-3. Chris Conto said, that place was nuts. And it's like hockey. Once you get engaged in it and you see it live,
right?
I think with Mr. Vinnick buying the team in Tampa, too, down the road, what he did to expose the team marketing-wise, changing and adding to the arena, the new arena that came in there.
The arena and the neighborhood around the arena
it's,
are great.
It's amazing, all the condos. But it was just, and winning. They had Stamkos, they had LeCavalier, they had, you know, Marty St. Louis. They had a good team and great coaching. Like, I talked to Rick Dudley about it the other day. Rick was a former teammate, and he's with the Panthers. He just had the cup up in Niagara Falls. He's won two of them with Florida. And it's the same thing. Well, ownership, good organizational staff, and great players. And It's really cool to see. I mean, for now that I live and a resident of Tampa, of Florida, to see that happening.
Yeah. Well, it's great. It's great for the game, and it just
it is
to show that, you know. But you brought up a good point. To appreciate the sport of hockey, you have to see it live.
No, and they couldn't believe this. Like, women went nuts. It was like, this game is, these guys are crazy. It's entertaining. I mean, and when you win, I mean, it's been difficult for me to live in Tampa and watch what's happening here in Buffalo for the last 10 years. I mean, it's frustrating, but that's what has to happen back in Buffalo again, is, you know, try to find some ingredients that can help move them forward
and create that
buzz again, like I had when I played here.
Well, when I moved here, and I stole this to Tim, I mean, this is, you know, this is as good of a hockey town as anywhere in the United States.
Yeah.
And when the team does turn around, wow, it'll be great.
Well, you know, we talked earlier about the Bills and how the Bills, and God bless them. I love what's happening. It shows that this, you know, this can't happen, because when I played, we were bigger than the Bills.
Sure.
They had OJ, they had the electric company, but it was like we were the town, you know, the team in the town. And I guess, you know, it's cyclical like anything else, but you were here in 99. You experienced it.
It was every restaurant, every bar. It was
everywhere.
It was insane.
For, you know, when you think about it, I was thinking about driving down here, you know, the economic impact that sports does, as you know, for a city. I mean, look at what the Bills, I mean, if the Sabres, you know, if we could ever get them all together winning, but even the Bills for what they're bringing in.
And the Bills are, what, 8-9 home games, 16-17 overall.
Yeah.
But, you know, you got 82, now going to be 84 nights.
42 home games. Yeah.
42
it's
home
a lot.
Games, yeah. We want to get to present, because I think this was top of our agenda. It's funny how we segue from a non-traditional hockey market with, in many cases, no ice. that being Tampa,
true,
to what you're doing now. And I think I'd like to talk to you a little bit, Danny. You're a partner in a company called Can Ice.
Can Ice, yeah.
Can Ice. So this is synthetic, non-frozen ice. So just give us, give our listeners background on Can Ice.
Okay. Been doing it for over a dozen years. When I left Columbus, it was my last broadcasting gig, kind of. I went to Tampa and got friends with a gentleman called Mike McGraw, my partner. He plays at the same golf course that I play at, and I was introduced to him by my friend Swenny again. And I was amazed at what he was talking about, because he was just in Norway at a convention, and he's in the sports servicing business for over 40 years at the time. He started with Monsanto back in the day, and they had synthetic, some type of synthetic back then, but mostly it was AstroTurf, and they were, he was the one that started AstroTurf. Mm. So the guy had went to Cornell, or Columbia, I should say, smart Ivy Leaguer. And I was like, okay. I said, I don't mind, you know, talking to you about it and getting involved. So I wrote down some things that I thought could help, you know, in synthetic ice product. And so we brought it over for about 4 or 5 years. And my thing was, and I always said to Mike, synthetic ice is good. You know, I used to shoot pucks off a piece of plywood with wax when I was younger, to get the, you know, the feel of shooting 300-400 pucks a day when I was younger. And I always wanted to think that synthetic ice was about glide. It had to be similar to what the ice is, very similar, you know. So we went around to a number of ejection molders in Canada, the United States, looking for this hard-type surface, acrylic almost, if you want to call it. And ejection molding wouldn't do it. And I've learned a lot about polymers. I'm telling you about I think I have a master's degree in this stuff after doing it for over a dozen years. But in saying that, we hooked up with a company in Tampa. We finally found this company that did plastics, and they told me to bring my skates out, and they had some panels, and I skated on them in the glide, but it was manufactured different. It wasn't ejection mold, it was heat plant press. So the polymers, and they had these machines that would just press down on it and make it hard, so when you put on your skates, you just glide over it. You just take off, and you could stop on it, no problem. And a lot of the times you'd get this dandruff from, you know, and you'd also have to put this glide spray on it. So this stuff was all done inside of the panel, and it bleeded through the panel. So it was really the highest part of technology. They're probably one of the second largest plastics company in North America. So we've been using them as our manufacturer, and it's been unbelievable as far as development for the game, growing the game, especially in the Florida area and the hotter areas like Dallas or California. And even for a youngster, if I was a parent, what you're paying for ice times and travel teams and so forth and so on, Timmy, I'd get an area 20 by 20 where little Johnny can go down and skate and shoot in the basement or his backyard. So in that regard, it's been a very positive thing for me, because I think it's helping growing the game. We've talked to USA Hockey. I'm having a big meeting on Wednesday with Hockey Canada to, you know, to talk about growth of the game and the costs of what it costs, you know, to build arenas. We've done a number of arenas that have, you know, redone their surfaces, and there's no refrigeration, there's no maintenance, and so forth. So my thing is, I wish I had this when I was a kid, you know, to be honest with you. So we're very happy with the company.
I've spent a lot of time on it. And so who is, I mean, and there'll be a range of answers to this, but who is your target audience?
It's funny you say that. I think, God, we've had probably 2-3 dozen NHL players that use it, you know, for training in their summertime. They build it so they don't have to go to the rink. They do all their skills, their stick handling, their inside-outside edges, their shooting drills. I mean, that's a big plus for us. Crosby, Taves, you know, I can go on, Pavelski, Marchessault. All these guys are using it, Vasilevskiy, Kucherov. And the other side of it is youth, kids, you know, kids that are learning to play the game or kids that are good at it. You know, residential areas, and a lot of it is institutional too. We do a lot of institutional for parks, recreations. I just see where West Seneca's looking to, they got turned down for $40 million. I'm going to have to go talk to those boys because, you know, this thing, it would be a lot more reasonable. And we've done a number of, you know, arenas, because it's cheaper and it's, and it lasts, you know, and it's no maintenance, and the glide factor now is almost similar to ice. So that's how my big thing was.
And I would encourage anyone out there who hasn't seen it. I mean, go find a Can Ice.
Go on the
rink,
website.
Or
check
go on the website.
Out.
Yeah,
go
yeah.
check. We've got some great videos on there. There's we've got different types of sizes and different you know, areas that you can just pop in. Different pricing areas. We have a premier product. We have a, you know, a product Snipe Master that's great for young kids. You know, a mom can snap it down and put it together. And
I think when you need a mallet, right?
Little rubber mallet. Yeah.
Well, not too bad.
It seems to me, as we talk about different kind of sports complexes that, you know, municipalities are building, right? Whether it's soccer pitches, whether it's flag football fields,
right.
It just seems from a municipal perspective, having this surface is part of that overall youth sports.
Well, and it combines to, like, you can do a rink, an ice rink, but add one of these on the side, you know, like where it's much less, you know, could be, you know, much cheaper. Or we've done a lot of training centers, you know, like across Canada and the United States, where people use it to, as an income. The kids can come in and shoot off it and skate off it, and they've had these stalls. And, but I think municipalities, for the costs and the problem of finding rinks, you know, and the ability just to have a functional area where you can do the same things as you can on ice for development, you know. I mean, I think it's all about development skill levels, and at any time use it, and cheaper for the municipalities. I mean, much cheaper than rinks.
Well, I know, you know, I'm involved in a couple of not-for-profit rinks, and
by
far the number one expense is electricity,
the refrigeration,
to keep the chillers cranking. Yeah. So you eliminate
You eliminate it. And the nice thing about it is, you know, we did our first one in Old Bridge, New Jersey. It was an open air rink, okay, that was sponsored by the Devils. We put it in, and they use it all year round. I mean, all the summer times, the kids are in shorts skating on it. You know, wintertime, they're playing games on it.
Yeah. So. Anybody, and we talk a lot about the accessible sports. Have you ever seen sled hockey?
Sled hockey we're talking about because it doesn't, the spikes on them, okay. I've done it. I've used it. It does not get into the, you know, into the panel or dig into it like a skate does, because the polymers are so, they're virgin polymers, but they're high-end quality polymers, which is what you need in order to get the surface that hard.
Yeah.
So it's, and kids just fly over it. I mean, they're so light. They hardly, like, I've skated on it. There's the odd little groove you get, you know, because I'm a little bigger and push a little harder. But no, you can play anytime, anywhere.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
Well, John. Have you skated on it yet?
I actually have, but it was
in our early years.
It was early generation, early development, and you would do a hockey stop, and there would be a little bit of shavings.
Dandruff, we call it.
Yeah, but and it was great. I was blown away because I you know, this was actually on the beach in LA.
But you could glide maybe 3-4 feet
on
a push off.
Right.
9 now can go by 20.
Yeah,
I mean it's just technology, Timmy.
Yeah,
and it's changing all the time. We're always trying to stay on top of it. But I'd match our product against anyone that's out there. Yeah, I don't want to be a little biased, but
you get it. That's a bias.
But I've been doing it for a long time. I put my time in, my sweat equity. So, and it's been fun doing. I mean, I get to, when I see guys like Kucherov put in his garage. I mean, this guy's the best I went and cleaned out his old stuff that he had, and we put ours in, and it took me probably 20 minutes to get 500 pucks out of the net. That's how many pucks he shoots a day, you know, like I was saying, and that's why he's one of the best players in the game. But he loved our ice, yeah.
Yeah, that's yeah. great.
Well, it's a bias you've absolutely earned, and Danny, it's the credibility is there, right?
Yeah.
No. I mean, it's great to hear about this, and you know, to John's point, if this is something that can continue to make this sport more accessible to kids,
yeah, growing the game is what it's all about for me. I mean, like you say, we talked about the Tampa and being. I was the first announcer there. I was so proud of that, and I know that. I know that, you know, to see what as accomplished, you know, in those areas where now we're doing it in Europe, we're doing it. We're talking to some people in Israel that want our product. You know, I mean, it's just, I love the game of hockey. I've always loved the game of hockey. It's been great to me. So if this will give back a little bit, then fill our boots.
Awesome. Yeah.
Well,
awesome.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
Well, Danny, thank you for contributing to the great sport of hockey.
Thanks, John.
For a few years, and more importantly, for continuing to grow the game. So I want to thank you for being with Tim and I here on Skin of the Game, and we'll be right back after this.
Corey here with the Compact Civics Expansion Pack.
America is such a big, wide, awesome place, and to be able to see things that are representative of so many different places can be so important when brought to your tiny town.
Everybody is so kind and loving. I'm here in Buffalo just because of State Buffalo.
From urban farms to rural fairs, we'll celebrate spaces that bring us together and create community.
Watch on the Buffalo Toronto Public Media YouTube channel.
From your morning commute to quiet evenings at home, Buffalo Toronto Public Media is always there. With trusted news, inspiring stories, and timeless music, it's your connection to a world of wonder. This is Public Media.
Hey, welcome back to Skin in the Game. And I want to thank Danny Gehr for joining us here. And Tim, it was great to get Danny here in studio.
That was a nice mix, John, of a lot of memories, a lot of nostalgia, but talking too about the cool things he's doing today. And, you know, it's hitting one of the themes you and I have really built on Skin in the Game, which is what can we do to make sports like hockey more accessible to kids? And we talk about equipment and coaching. Well, access to ice, or in this case, synthetic ice, can really do the trick.
First of all, I've known Danny since I moved to Western New York, and has been a friend since. And he's such a great friend and ambassador for the game of hockey. And I think what he's doing now with Can Ice, and as you said, making the game of hockey more accessible, especially in some non-traditional markets, is great. So he continues to contribute to the sport that, as he said, gave him so much as well.
Yeah, and he knows those non-traditional markets as well as he knows the traditional ones. He played in some real, you know, some of the biggest traditional hockey markets on this continent, but you know, now he's living in Florida, at least splitting his time.
Yeah, splitting his time. Yep.
NHL hockey has been incredibly successful in Florida, or at least in parts of Florida. What do you do to, you know, build that out from the youth level up?
Yeah.
And, you know, and what Danny's doing and what that company's doing is a big part of that.
Well, you know, we talked about a few episodes back, we had a whole roller hockey themed, right? And as I said, when I was in Los Angeles, well, street hockey, roller hockey were real gateways into building a passion for the sport. And I think what's happening with Can Ice and helping get the sport of hockey in some of these non-traditional markets is real, real similar to that. What I also thought, though, was fun, the conversation with Danny, was the trip down memory lane. And the conversation when he was literally mowing his lawn, which sounds like a pretty big uphill lawn, when he got the call that he got drafted by the Sabres. Wow, have times changed.
I did not know that story. I know that drafts used to be incredibly low-key. Exciting when you got the call, like life-changingly so, but not necessarily a big deal, you know? And for Danny, it meant the, well, in the most immediate sense, it meant the lawn wasn't going to get cut quite as fast.
Right.
But he still finished it.
Yeah. Well, that was a great story. The one story we didn't get to with Danny that I just wanted to kind of highlight is he was talking to us earlier this year. He had time to reminisce. It was a reunion of the 1976 Team Canada team, which many have said is the best hockey team ever assembled. And, you know, he was in the room with legends, Serge Savard, Larry Robinson, Bobby Orr. I mean, the
Marcel,
Gilbert Perreault. And it was just great for him to get together with those guys and kind of relive those really historic moments. So for any of our Canadian listeners, the 76 team on their 50th anniversary did get back together in Montreal. And from what Danny said, you know, everybody kind of picked up right where they left off.
And I would say, go find the video that's out there, but it sounds like Danny might have been one of the only people actually shooting video at this reunion. So we may have to hit him up to share a little of that sometime.
Yeah. Well, and the last thing I just want to touch on is I think how you were chatting with Danny and how he quickly transitioned, you know, once his on-ice playing days were over, how quickly he pivoted and found some mentors, but also found an opportunity to stay involved in the game, in this case, you know, on the broadcasting side. So I just, you know, we've talked to a lot of athletes, and back then there wasn't that kind of formal planning for your next stage, you know, your next career. But it sounds like, again, with the support of a lot of mentors here in Buffalo as well as beyond, he was able to find that second career,
which is so important for athletes. Just like any, I mean, think of it this way: when you have young people who are graduating college, or might be, you know, college could be several years, you know, in, over their shoulder behind them, they need mentor. Older people need mentors too, but especially people who are building a new career need that mentorship. That includes hockey players, athletes in their 30s, you know, late 20s. Who are ending one thing, which could very much define their, you know, their entire adult career, right? And you don't necessarily want it to do that. It might be the thing people remember you for, but you've got decades in front of you, you know, right. Decades and decades in front of you, and you've got to be able to do something productive with it. I don't know what kind of money Danny made as a hockey player. I'm going to guess that he was not, knowing when he retired, he was probably not in a position to simply stop working. He probably had to do...
With his energy and
would
his
he
passion,
stop working?
He would
right.
not. He would not stop
And I don't
working.
Know him like you do, but it's that's obvious in about within 3 seconds of meeting him that this guy's not going to sit still.
Yeah.
But you want to do something productive and high level, and that's that athlete mentality. And, you know, as an athlete, you have coaches. As a professional, you go find mentors.
Right. So again, I want to thank Danny Gare for joining us on Skin in the Game. And I want to thank all of our listeners. And for myself and Tim O'Shea, thanks for joining us. This is a production of Buffalo Toronto Public Media. Thanks for listening.